Well, I do not keep a deep reservoir of football stories to draw upon. As a new football season unfolds, I thought I would share probably my only football story with you. It's a little dated, smells a little like mothballs, but it has to do with Ken Stabler, who back in the 1980s was the great left-handed quarterback for the Oakland Raiders. Stabler was interviewed one day by a sports writer who read aloud to him the personal creed of the novelist short story writer Jack London. Sort of this I believe, according to Jack London. And after he had read the paragraph to Stabler, the reporter wanted to know what Stabler thought of it. Here's what London had written. "I would rather be ashes than dust. I would rather my spark burn out in a brilliant blaze than to be stifled by dry rot. Because, you see, the perfect function of a human being is to live, not simply to exist. I shall never waste my days trying to prolong them. I shall use my time." When the reporter had finished reading, he asked the quarterback, "How does that credo strike you?" After a pause, Stabler replied with two splendid words from his world, the world of baseball. "What I hear London saying, sir, is simply this: throw deep. Throw deep." I thought of those two words as I studied the 12th chapter of Genesis this week. Abraham, the grand patriarch of our faith tradition, and Sarah, our matriarch, were not afraid to throw deep. They may have had to wrestle from time to time with self-doubt, but they never doubted that God would be able to do what God had promised. When the visitors came to their tent and announced that Sarah, who was old enough to be a great-grandmother, was going to have a baby of her own, they did laugh a little bit. But they never stopped trusting God, the God who had said to them, "I want you to go to the land of Canaan, and there I'm going to make of you a great nation." And so they went. They packed it up, the pots and the pans and the linens in the drawer, the donkeys and the goats, all headed out for Canaan on the basis of nothing more than the promise of an invisible God, and a God with whom Abram did not even have a very strong personal relationship yet. At that time in his country, there were many gods vying for the attention and loyalty of the people. Abram must have liked this God, Yahweh, but he did not know that God well. But still and all, away they went. The first thing that happened was that when they got to where they were going, Abraham's nephew Lot chose the rich bottom land, and Abraham settled on the less fertile ground. The second thing that happened was that no baby came. No baby. It's hard to imagine becoming the father of a great nation if the lights are out in the nursery. Later, of course, you've read on in the story, Isaac was born. But when Isaac was still a boy, the Lord commanded Abram, now Abraham, to take Isaac, his only son, the son whom he loved, and make of him a burnt offering on Mount Moriah. And there Isaac was, all tied up, lying on the woodpile. Abraham with the knife in his hand to stab his own son to death. when at the last second the Lord intervened and called off the sacrifice, it pushed Abraham to the limit of his faith and trust. And through that dark incident, it was revealed that Abraham was one who would go deeper than deep. He would go all the way for God. There is a quotation from John Stuart Mill that I like. "One believer is worth 99 people who just might be interested." The Lord needed Abram and his total commitment. The Lord's plan of salvation was too important to entrust to someone who just would put a little toe down into the future and see if the water was cold or hot and then decide. Abraham, Father Abraham, we call him. Perhaps the most outstanding person we encounter in the Hebrew Scriptures. I understand that Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin called her former pastor at the Assembly of God Church shortly after she had been elected governor of Alaska. She wanted her pastor to recommend biblical stories that revealed people who were great leaders so that she could learn the secrets of their leadership. I think the more important question is how God's greatness is manifested in ordinary people and how God guides, directs, and inspires ordinary people in the fulfillment of God's gracious and divine plans. The Bible is first and last the story of God. It begins with God's calling the universe into being and pronouncing it good. And yet almost immediately bad things begin to happen. The eating of the apple, the killing of Abel by Cain, the wickedness that so grieved the heart of God that the floods came and covered the earth. And then after the floods, the building of that terrible Tower of Babel, which displeased the Lord just about as much as anything ever did. Scholar Leon Cass helps us understand what happens next. The Tower of Babel marked the end of the saga of universal human beginnings. After Babel, God has a change of plans. God abandons his plan to work with the entire human race all at one time, but he in no way abandons his universal aspirations for human beings. He pursues the same ends, but by different means. He now chooses to work through one nation as a light to all the others. One nation, no stronger than the others, no better, no wiser than the others, no greater track record than anybody else. They were tent dwellers, and for reasons known only to the Lord, the Lord chose these people, this family, to be a blessing to the rest of the world. When they set out, Sarah and Abraham, they had a great deal to learn, and along the way they messed up royally more than a few times. But God had a plan, and so he taught them and forgave them and guided them so that after a while, they became useful to the plan of salvation and aware that anything good that happened, including the gift of children, was not a human achievement, but only the occasion for wholehearted, reverential thanksgiving to the Almighty. Genesis 12 begins, as Chris read it, I want you to go from your house and your kinfolk and your father's house, and I'm going to make of you a great nation. It all sounds nice until you think of what has to be left behind. They are leaving their secure world and stepping out toward God knows what. But listen, as one scholar says, and this is so important, such a departure from security is the only way out of barrenness. To stay safe is to be barren, to be without life. But to leave in risk is to have hope. One cannot help think of the invitation of Jesus. Those who want to save their lives will lose them. And those who are willing to lose their lives for my sake and for the sake of the gospel, you are the ones who will find your life. Anybody want to come? History's hinge is right here. History hinges on those who say yes or no to the hopeful future that God offers. If I had to come up with a motto by which I might live, here would be the words I would use. Not a bad exercise to think of what set of words summarize your own life. Hear mine. Live by faith. Throw deep, risk it all in the service of hope. I have learned by stepping out and then stepping out again and then stepping out again, particularly in seemingly hopeless situations, I have learned that I am never sorry. I have never been sorry that I let go of what was, so that what new thing God wanted to do could be born. A New Yorker cartoon several years ago showed a woman lashing storage jars on a donkey and explaining to her neighbor, "We're moving to some place called Canaan. It's going to be a whole new concept in group living." I kind of like this version of stripping the story down to its bare bones. Here's the whole plot. Act one. Go. Act two. We're going, we're going. At the behest of God, the camel train pulls out, and the world has never been the same again. Paul can take the long view. He can see what it meant. He can see that Abraham and his descendants, the children of God chosen in the first place, those who are the Gentiles who have been included in the covenant, they are the inheritors of the gracious promises of God. You see, when God makes a promise, that promise will be kept, even if it takes the Son of God climbing up on or being nailed to, better said, a cross. And when the hammer is raised and the wood is about to be kindled, or when the nails are about to be driven into the hand, the loving Father of us all does not say stop. Grace, his gracious nature wouldn't let him. The point always was to redeem the world. And if it took God's own Son to do it, then so be it. What are we to do with this story of Abraham in a world that is as unlike Abraham's world as we can possibly imagine, but is it really? Anybody here have a little bit of anxiety about the future? A little worry about what's going to happen next? Whom the next president will be? Who will lead us? What direction our country will go in? Whether our economy is going to sink into recession? Whether our world so full of hot spots is going to catch on fire with anger and hatred. We are in a way like Abram and Sarai, aren't we? We have no way of knowing what's ahead. But one thing we do know is that God needs us. God needs us to help create the future that God has in mind. God is not picky about that kind of thing. What God is looking for is people who will say yes, not people who are perfect. God is looking for a new generation who not only will be heirs of Abraham, but who will be willing to be a part of the new family of humanity that God is creating in the 21st century. Yes, this old story, it applies to us. It applies to our church as here at Morningside, we move into unknown territory, and holy smokes, the challenges that are before us. And some of us might be tempted to say, no, thank you. I believe we'll stay right here where we are. Comfortably, we can stay here. But we have the sense that we also can respond as Abram and his family did with faithfulness. Letting go of our need to have everything stay just in place so that we can become, listen, we can become the hinge on which history and our little part of the world turns. Imagine if the faithfulness of this congregation was really the transforming power in town Atlanta. It's possible if we draw deeply from our spiritual resources and muster the courage to face what is ahead, knowing that our security lies not in the status quo. Our security lies where it always has been, in the steady, strong hands of a mighty and gracious God. I just passed over 3 pages of this sermon because I want to say 2 things and then I close. I think of the children, the over 100 children that are a part of our community these days. And I think of the children in a Sunday school class whose teacher asked them 2 questions. Do you love God? And secondly, why do you love God? All the children said yes to the first question. Yes, I love God. But they were silent. No one could think of an answer to why they loved God until one kid had a light bulb go off and raised his hand. He said, I think that kind of thing runs in our family. Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Mary and Joseph, generation to generation. We teach our children that God can be trusted, that God is love, that God cares, that the outcome of history is in the hands of a gracious God. And then just this to end on closer to the other end of the spectrum of life. A man I've always admired is a man named Dr. Henry Mitchell, an outstanding African-American preacher and teacher of preaching. Several years ago, he found himself needing angioplasty, and he wrote this: "I lay on the metal table, and I watched the cardiologist move a balloon inside my heart. He opened up a most important artery inside that had ceased to function. I watched with utter awe as the balloon passed painlessly back and forth. I could not help thinking that what I was seeing in my heart, in that cardiologist's hand, what I was seeing was the providential hand of God using a gifted doctor to lengthen out the threads of my life. My sometimes feeble faith was so affirmed and so strengthened that tears of joy flowed down my cheeks throughout the entire angioplasty. I had the feeling of fullness. It was like that feeling of the old people in my home church who seem filled up to the brim with praise and thanksgiving to God. There are moments when life itself throws us deep, and then we sense so clearly that divine grace undergirds absolutely everything. As Paul put it, by the grace of God, I am what I am, and God's grace toward me is not in vain." Thanks be to God for this encouraging word.